Like, I'm basically doing the job of a junior manager.
Yeah, and you're helping out with all the Grayson stuff.
Yes! He's basically my client.
His Chipotle bowl? That was all you.
I mean, it was me and Courtney together, but I came up with the caption. Yeah. And people loved the caption. I mean, it was so popular that afterwards, they sold out of corn.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 587 for the week of November 3rd, 2025. I am Sepulveda, the street that's everywhere, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Quiet Confidence, Sarah D. Bunting.
Overlook me.
Courage Bagel, Tara Ariano.
Wait, how much is this?
And Strategic Frenemy, Nick Reinwell Jones.
No, you're awesome.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Before we get into this episode, we have a call for submissions. We had so much fun with our last Would You Rather episode earlier this year. We're doing another one. So if you, listener, have a TV-related Would You Rather scenario that you need us to talk about, you can send it to us in a voice memo. Don't forget to give your name up top and email it to me, tara@extrahotgreat.com. Exactly as it sounds, no hyphens or anything. And we will also put that email in the show notes. We would love to hear from you. And if only one half of your scenario is TV related, that is fine. Now, welcome back, Nick Reinwell Jones.
Nick.
Hello. Yay! Yes, normally I say, he's a writer and director you've heard with us many times before, and I got distracted because of my show notes. We are here to talk about I Love L.A., in which Maya, Rachel Sennett, is an assistant at an L.A. management company, frustrated that she hasn't had any upward motion there in years. On her 27th birthday, she goes on Instagram and gives herself the gift of blocking Tallulah, Odessa Azian, a frenemy whose career as an influencer Tallulah owes to Maya. Unfortunately, when Maya then goes into work and asks her boss, Alyssa, Leighton Meester, for a promotion they talked about and gets told she doesn't have the requisite experience, Maya is forced to mention Tallulah, who now appears to have no connection to her. Maya returns home defeated and finds out Tallulah has just flown in from New York and plans to stay a while, which means the two of them are forced to work things out for the sake of both their careers. Rachel Sennett also created the show, the pilot of which was directed by Laureen Scafaria. Only one episode has aired so far on HBO. We got access to the whole season, but we will be careful about spoilers from episodes that have not aired yet. Let's do the Chen check-in. Nick, should our listeners watch I Love LA?
Yes, but I would say you definitely have to watch past the pilot to appreciate it.
Sarah.
Interesting. Yeah, it's a hard no for me.
Dave.
You have no concept of the depth of my ire.
I'm going to keep watching it, but I'm only going to watch one episode at a time because it's a lot. This is a show about irritating characters, and sometimes you only need that just a drip at a time. Let's get into it. Speaking of irritating characters, the show is drawing comparisons to Girls, which I can see they're both about groups of friends in a big city with a protagonist who's trying to move up in a creative industry. Nick, do you feel it is an accurate reflection of where culture is today that whereas Hannah's career goal is to write a book, Maya's career goal is to get one of her more annoying friends a leggings collab?
If anything, I think it's much more realistic for where things are now than Girls was in 2012. But
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I try not to participate in We Are So Cooked discourse, but it feels kind of impossible not to hear. Having watched further than the rest of us did, what are your thoughts on this as a reflection of cookedness?
After watching the pilot, I definitely was mixed to negative on it. And I said something out loud to the TV, with my wife Alexis in the room, but mostly out loud to the TV that they mirror something you just said. I just said, that was a lot. but having watched further, and I really think like it gets better with each subsequent episode after the pilot, because I think what's unclear about the pilot, and I think this is on the show, if anything, you know, more than it's on us. It's just hard to tell, like, how seriously am I supposed to take any of this in the pilot? And I think, you know, especially because this exists in the shadow of Girls, which is a show that obviously was goofy and ridiculous in some respects, but ultimately was pretty earnest and you were supposed to take fairly seriously. I think it's easy to think like, oh, this is like Girls and I am supposed to find some thread of seriousness and earnestness to hold on to through this, even though the main character is the manager of an influencer. But with each subsequent episode, it gets gets clear that that is not the case, and it actually is just living for its own ridiculousness. It's much more in like the Seinfeld Curb area of things. And yes, everyone is annoying and kind of awful, but like once you sort of get used to them and you do realize that like you don't really have to be rooting for them, you can just watch them sort of fall on their asses, then it becomes a really fun show, I think. So I watched the first four episodes. Episode two was better than the pilot. Episode three was better than two. And then episode four is probably the best one so far, but the whole thing takes place at like a ridiculous LA house party and everyone kind of gets into their own misadventures and stuff. Now I'm pretty well into the show and we'll definitely keep watching. But with some shows, like, you know, you go back to like The Office and Parks and Rec, where they had to do the kind of boring work of laying out the characters and dynamics before you could really find it as funny as it was. And I think maybe something similar is happening here, where the pilot is pretty concerned with laying down the tracks for the premise and who the characters are and what the relationship is to each other. And they just don't have a chance to be quite as ridiculous as they can get once they've established that. If you think you're up for it, just commit yourself to watching the first two.
Okay. Sarah, I think of you as a social anthropologist of female friendship. So leaving aside the show's specifically Zoomer aspect, how true to life would you say the Maya Tallulah connection is for you?
I mean, I was of two minds about it. Like, I did have some notes that were like, they do a good job with the secret language of besties and that sort of shorthand that is like, it hints at a whole story leading up to the secret language, but you don't necessarily know it. I thought that was good. I thought this sort of like girl world frenemyship was well drawn or sort of well sketched. But then at the same time, I didn't feel like Tallulah's turn, that sort of twist at the end of the pilot, was set up well by her behavior up to that point in the episode. I think for what this is, it's done quite well. I always love Meester. She is perfectly cast here. There were a lot of good lines. I don't think this is bad. I think it's just like a forcefully not for me. And that's kind of how I felt about the sort of girl world aspects of it, that it's like, I think this is probably pretty well done. But like with girls, like this is either too close or too much or too something. And I'm not doing it.
Yeah. Dave, that's basically your thought as well. I asked at the end of the first episode, do you want to watch another one? No. I felt like I knew the answer, but you know, I had to check.
Tara always says I read a different internet than she does and other people. Yes. And it's because I don't want to deal with things like this. I really hate this whole influencer culture all the same reasons. Before we had this, I hated like diva culture, Real Housewives culture. I just genuinely don't like these people in the way they act. Playing in that sandbox is fine, and I concede that they could be doing it very well. And if you're like Nick and you just give yourself to a certain way of watching it, then you will enjoy it. I am not capable of that. So I'm sort of agreeing with Sarah here. It's just like too much for me, and I just can't get into it on a base level because I don't enjoy swimming in these waters.
Right. There's a certain level of hateful character that you can engage with in a comedy. And this is like in a different category that you have no interest.
Yeah. I mean, you guys have been mentioning girls so far. Like, I would also put this in the bucket of Sex and the City, where I just like, I don't care. Like, it's a foreign world to me. And I just like, I can't relate to anything. And also, I'm scared.
Right.
So what I'm saying here is I'm not really qualified to criticize this show.
Fair enough. Okay. So when a creator is also the star of their show, I think we need to know early on they're not going to attack their role with too much vanity. Nick, how did you feel Sennett is on this front?
So I knew her mostly from Bottoms, which she...
I loved her in Shiva Baby. That was a great movie.
Yeah, she's very good too.
That's really good.
When I was thinking of like who she reminds me of, especially a few episodes in, I was like, oh, like in some ways the movie or the show a little bit reminds me of the movie Go. And she is a little bit like the Sarah Polley character who's like just sort of trying to stay like head above water amid all the absolute insanity around her and is still a little bit insane herself, but like is trying to be marginally less so than the people around her.
It's a good comp.
So yeah, I think she does a good job of that. She definitely doesn't give herself all the best lines. you are marginally supposed to root for her, I guess, but also it's clear very early on just kind of like how ridiculous her goals are. You know, that does give the show some semblance of stakes that you kind of need even for a ridiculous comedy. She's definitely not making herself the hero in any way.
Right. And for more on Go, by the way, join us on Again with This, because we're going to be talking about that on December 12th. We just recorded that one last week. Such a good movie still.
Mm-hmm.
Odessa Asion, I think, has the toughest job of any cast member since she has to be extremely grating, but also like strangely lovable. Sarah, what was your feeling about her performance?
I thought she was outstanding. That was one of the things about the girl world of it that I really thought they nailed.
Mm-hmm.
Is that I think women all have that one charismatic, it's like a sparkler, but it's just like spraying sparks onto things that you own and leaving little burn marks. And you're just like, oh my God, I'm so tired. And now this top is mesh and I didn't ask for this. And she gets at like that. It's right on the line of like, you're too annoying for me to keep knowing, like her just sort of wandering out into traffic and leaving the car door open.
I love that.
And then almost getting run over.
Mm-hmm.
But then just sort of like that energy and that appealing, like weather-esque, you can't say no to it, forcefulness of personality.
Mm-hmm.
I thought she did a great job. And in terms of the acting of that twist at the end of the first episode, like I said, I think she pulled it off performance-wise. I just mm-hmm. didn't buy it like in the writing necessarily. But I also think if this is a show for you or that you're interested in, that performance was critical to nail that kind of ineffable energy that you're just absolutely worn out by. But mm-hmm. also, again, it's like watching a storm come in. You're like, that's gonna can take the roof off, but looks really cool and pretty from way out here. And then yeah. it arrives.
To me, she's like the way that like Quentin Tarantino is able to take these like ridiculous like genre characters and then like ground them just enough that they're like compelling and still being ridiculous. I feel like she's the Jenna Maroney of that on this show.
Yeah.
Yes. You definitely see it in the first episode when they're talking about going to the beach, which, by the way, when she's like, let's just go. And all the Angelinas are like, no,
there's
we
no
have to leave
just.
At 8 in the morning.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
But then, you know, she also doesn't have a swimsuit. And then she borrows one and comes out. And Charlie, played by Jordan Firstman, who's another member of the friend group, he's a fashion stylist. And just you can tell he hates this girl. But when she comes out in this looks like fetish gear, just under his breath, he's like, fuck, it's fabulous. That was fuck, it's fabulous, whispered in case Zooms fucks me again like it did on Friday's episode. Anyway, she also, I would say, let us know what it might be like if Alia Shawkat and Tatiana Maslany had a baby. Because I saw her last week in the trailer for Marty Supreme and was like, oh, that's not Alia Shawkat. Okay, good to know. Once you know that Alani, another member of the friend group, is played by True Whitaker, as in daughter of Forrest, and the worst actor in the core cast, in my opinion, it starts to feel rude that her character is daughter of a showbiz mogul who has a fake job at his production company. But Nick, does she get better after the pilot?
I think she definitely gets better.
Okay.
Yeah.
And also, Odessa Asion has a famous parent, too. She is the daughter of Pamela Adlon, who does not go by that name. Yeah,
that is wild
crazy.
To me. At first, I was like, oh, and then you hear it mm-hmm. like the rasp. You absolutely hear it.
Oh, yeah. I got to tell Alexis that because Better Things is like her favorite show ever.
Yeah. So one of those girls is probably based on her. Anyway.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why Josh Hutcherson wanted to play main girl's boring, safe boyfriend, but good for him, I guess. Nick, does he show more dimensionality as the season goes on?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that it's like, it's almost like they decide right off the bat, like, well, we just need one person who's going to be like kind of normal and just weirdly putting up with all this. Mm-hmm. And he does get more to do in other episodes, but yeah, I think he fills that role well.
And just before we wrap up, I feel like we need to give a shout out to both Leighton Meester and Courage Bagels, which are having a hot fall appearing in this show, and nobody wants this both. So,
yeah, Stealth Leighton Meester is in, like, I didn't realize that this was Leighton Meester, and my wife Alexis didn't realize that Leighton Meester was the one on Nobody Wants This until uh-huh. we looked them up, and it's like, wow.
And nobody realizes that she makes the bagels at Courage Bagels.
Oh my God.
Got a lot of shows. It's a great time for shows.
It's time to go around that aisle first up, Tara.
Yes. Speaking of nobody wants this, nobody wants this season two. Netflix's biggest think piece engine is back for its second season, already spawning one fucking terrible think piece I read this weekend that I'll link in the show notes that asked why they don't talk more about Gaza in this romantic comedy, and also brought up Zoran Mandani in passing regarding the show set in Los Angeles. But anyway, I talked about this show in season one. A hot rabbi named Noah, who's played by Adam Brody, Mr. Leighton Meester, meets a hot Gentile podcaster named Joanna, played by Kristen Bell. They have an instant attraction. Everyone knows it's fine for Noah to fool around with Joanne for a while, but if they were going to get serious, it would be a problem unless she decided to convert. And in the first season, her attitude is basically, sure, I'll convert. I have no particular convictions. So if this is the administrative business I have to go through to be with you, it doesn't matter to me. And Noah has to be like, no, it actually is a decision that has to matter to you. So in the finale, Joanne bravely breaks up with Noah for his sake, but he tells her he doesn't care about her faith or lack thereof, and they stay together. The show is loosely based on the real life experience of series creator Aaron Foster, also a podcaster who converted to Judaism after meeting the man who is now her husband. And in season two, it immediately becomes clear Noah was swept up in the moment and that he does still really want Joanne to convert, and brings it up a lot. And she has to keep asking him if this is something she needs to decide right now. And he's like, I guess no, but it would be great if you did. So even as they have the usual new couple fights, like what it means for Noah to say he wants to take a night off from Joanne before a job interview, because, oh yeah, when he that rabbi at Noah's temple finds out Joanne still hasn't decided about converting, Noah gets passed over to replace him when he retires. So Noah quits. Those kind of fights amid the overarching conversion dispute. And as I said when I talked about season one, it's not for me to say whether the Jewish characters, particularly the female ones, including Noah's sister-in-law Esther, who's played by Jackie Tone, and his mother Bina, played by Tova Feltsche, are offensive Jewish stereotypes. Jewish critics have written that they think that. I can't disagree with them, but what I know for sure is Esther and Bina are mean to Joanne, so I'm on their side anyway, and that is still largely true. But there's clearly been conscious effort in season two to make Esther more of a character than just a representation of everyone's issues with Noah dating someone who's not Jewish. What hasn't changed is Joanne and her sister Morgan, played by Justine Liu, are both still the specific kind of female asshole who has gotten away with it her whole life because she's hot. Point of Morgan's character is to show up somewhere dressed inappropriately and act like an entitled child right up until she suddenly has a new therapist boyfriend who was until very recently her therapist of several years. And leaving aside his unethically dating her, based on Morgan's behavior alone, he's also a bad therapist. But the biggest knock on the season is it kind of deposits the characters roughly where they were at the end of the first season. But it's so watchable. I put it on Friday night. I mowed through 7 episodes so fast. And when episode 9 came on, I was like, did I skip some? But no. Just they went down so smooth. So basically, this is a show about jerks who think their jerkishness is adorable, including Noah much of the time. And sometimes that's what you're in the mood for. I don't necessarily think the show's creators know that's what they made, but it's what we got. I also, though, have to mention they do product placement for both Love is Blind, which is also a show on Netflix, and Estee Lauder Advanced Night Repair Serum in 2 different episodes, and it is hilariously unsubtle. So you can also watch it for those clunkers, too. For my plug, Street Forum Austin is a mutual aid group that I have been volunteering with for the past year or so, and they are starting their fundraising for the fall season. So if you can donate to them, they would appreciate it. There's going to be a link in the show note. And if you would prefer to find a mutual aid group in your own locale, I strongly recommend you do that, because all of these groups, especially now, really need your help. And so do the people they serve. So look into that if you wish.
Nick, what do you have for us?
So it was a great summer for pulpy streaming shows. We had the unofficial trilogy of Sirens, The Hunting Wives, and The Girlfriend, all of them very good indoor beach reads, all of which could have been retitled Oh No She Didn't, which was allegedly the original title for the Beyoncé Ali Larter film, Obsessed. But heading into fall, one starts to crave a show with a little more meat on its bones. So luckily for us, along comes the recent Netflix miniseries Wayward, a twisty thriller about a school for the titularly wayward teenagers in a remote town in Vermont. Its creator and co-star is Mae Martin, the excellent Canadian comic who won Taskmaster a couple of years ago, but it's definitely not a comedy. And I came away from it incredibly impressed at what Martin was able to pull off in both writing and performance. It's reminiscent of watching Jordan Peele transition from Key and Peele to Get Out. This is a show with elements of Yellowjackets, Severance, Twin Peaks, and the Leanne Moriarty television universe. But it's set in 2003, and in many ways it feels like a throwback to the best of the WB and UPN shows, albeit more polished and fully TVMA. The teen characters are written very well, and the acting is great across the board, but unsurprisingly, the showstopper is Toni Collette, playing the Julianne Moore / Nicole Kidman role of the drunk-on-her-own-spiritual-bullshit headmistress. I also appreciate that it's a show that understands that we have busy lives and short attention spans. It's just 8 episodes. Most of them are well under an hour. There's no filler. The story never stops moving. I recommend it heartily. Part of it takes place in Toronto, so of course when that happens, I like to make the joke, oh, they're saying it's Toronto, but it was clearly shot in New York City. It's a great show, and definitely check it out if you want a good binge. I don't really have anything to plug right now, so I second Tara's encouragement to support, join everything, mutual aid, and food banks, because things are awful right now.
I'm going to cut that out. Or now I guess I can.
No, you can.
Let's all think about food banks for a moment. No. Sarah D. Bunting, what do you have? What have you been watching this
week? No good segue is what I have to Aileen, colon, Queen of the Serial Killers. That title is so bad.
How do you spell cereal?
Huh?
How do you spell cereal? Because this would be the greatest segue of all.
It could be, but unfortunately, it is the S-E-R-I-A-L, the U-N-D-Y version. This is a 1-hour-and-40-minute documentary from Netflix. That part is good. They didn't taffy pull it to 4 episodes. But the title is sort of emblematic of my issues with it. Like, I can't decide if that title is ironic and is supposed to point us to all the sort of flattened out 1.5-dimensional coverage of previous eras of Aileen Wuornos, or if it really is just like straight ahead clickbait for a generation that has never watched Monster and hasn't read a bunch of compendia about serial killers and don't know the story at all. If it's that second thing, it is not good at the case overview, really. It doesn't seem to know whether it's for people who have never heard of Aileen Wuornos or if it's for people steeped in the case lore. But then if it's the first thing, and if the director, Emily Turner, is commenting on everything that we didn't understand or take the time to nuance about this case 30-odd years ago, in which Wuornos, who was a serial killer and was sort of a, like, not that women can't be serial killers, but usually they're poisoning people or black widowing people or Munchausening people and fictitious disordering people, excuse me. And it doesn't usually take the form of like entrapping victims and then shooting them when it comes to a female perpetrator. She was also queer. There was like a lot of commentary about her looks and her queerness and all of that back then. And we, as is true of many cases from this era, from like the turn of the 90s, there were a lot of things we didn't understand about trauma and about perpetrators often being victims also, that it's always worth bringing these cases back and looking at them a little more dispassionately and compassionately. But Aileen colon Queen is not really committing to that stance either. It's not really commenting on any of the issues, which there's like a million capital I issues here, like starting with coerced confessions, how sexual assault survivors understand self-defense, the ethics of the death penalty for the mentally ill. Like, it is a lot. A 90s case reconsidered should probably engage with one or more of those issues instead of kind of collaging together footage that, granted, we haven't seen it before, but still, it felt a little bit fearful and noncommittal to me. With that said, it is very watchable. It does get at something about Aileen Wuornos' weird, grimy charisma, and maybe it did do the right thing for a 103-minute project in not trying to get its arms around the entire discourse. So Aileen colon Queen of the Serial Killers is on Netflix. My full review is at bestevidence.fyi. And for my other plug, On the same tip as mutual aid, little free pantries are springing up all over North America to help try to fill in the gap with SNAP coverage. You can find those at mapping.littlefreepantry.org, and we'll link it in the show notes.
Here's what's coming up on Extra Extra Hot Great this Friday. It is Death by Lightning, and that is about the assassination of Garfield. Which one? Watch to find out. Spoiler, I love this series.
It was really great.
Go to extrahotgreat.com/club if you want to join and pick that up. And then come back here next week, EHG Prime. We're going to be talking about Pluribus with Mr. Jeff Drake.
Do you know how worried I was? You disappeared in a vortex while I was in charge. For all I knew, you were dead or stuck in a dystopian San Francisco in the middle of a riot.
Did they notice that the references are weirdly specific?
Indeed.
That clip is halfway through the Strange New Worlds episode, Those Old Scientists, but I wanted to put it up front because it, I think, nicely encapsulates the reasons why I like this one for the canon. My argument for Those Old Scientists, the Strange New Worlds Lower Decks crossover episode, is not complicated. It is simply this. It is a fun mashup of the two Trek series that take themselves the least seriously. It blends each show's particular style into a whole full of goofy moments, tons of fan service, and a nice, sweet capper near the end. The basic storyline of the episode is the Lower Decks crew accidentally activates a time portal into which Boimler, that's Jack Quaid's character from the animated show Lower Decks, gets sucked into and lands him about 120 years in his past, where the Enterprise crew of Strange Worlds are also investigating the portal. He spends the episode starstruck by all these historical heroes of his, trying and failing to not drop morsels about the future. When they finally are able to send him home, Boimler's best friend, Mariner, Tawny Newsom, jumps through the portal from the future, trying to save him, but in fact trapping them both in the past with not enough portal juice for another go.
Yep.
The two Lower Deckers work their way through the cast. They pair him up for time travel jokes, references to the old series, as Boimler learns the people that he knows from history are all in the middle of their personal journeys towards the larger-than-life figures that he knows them as in his timeline. So, I simply wish to illustrate this, when possible, in audio. So let's start with all the fun stuff. At this point in the second season of the show, Spock, who is in a relationship with Nurse Chapel, is experimenting with human emotions. And that is not the Spock Boimler knows from history.
Anyway, we took a hollow image with our camera that emitted radioisotopes, which seemed to set it off. So I guess it was just dumb luck.
You just laughed?
Yes. The thought of assigning intelligence to chance struck me as ridiculous.
Okay.
When Orions, those are the green-skinned aliens from Star Trek, when they arrive in the area to investigate the portal, Boimler beseeches Pike to find a nonviolent solution, as everyone in this timeline prejudiciously thinks all Orions are pirates.
Sir, there has to be a peaceful solution, and I know diplomacy is one of your many, many strengths. That and patience, forgiveness, benevolence, really great hair.
The Orions.
When the Orions then take off with the portal in tow, the Enterprise struggles to find a way to track them, which leads to this clip in which a novel anti-paradox method is employed.
But as of now, there is no way to track the Orions.
I know how to track the Orions.
Didn't we talk about that?
Yes, using future knowledge. Yes, I know I shouldn't, but what if I could use it and you guys just don't look.
That's ridiculous. We can't just not look. Can we?
You can. It works. While we're busting tropes, why not one of TV's most universal ones?
Ideas. Not you. Fair?
Can you please tell Captain Pike that the Orions want to trade? They see it as a sign of respect.
You know I can hear you. I'm standing right here.
Sorry. I thought the span of the room would...
Captain.
Ethan Peck as young Spock obviously isn't the Spock the Lower Deckers know from history. Mariner, in particular, is gobsmacked.
Look, I'm going to keep this like 100% profesh, but I was thoroughly unprepared for how hot young Spock was going to be.
Yeah, he's full of surprises.
Like what? The body, the face, the ears, what?
I realize we're all still reacting.
But young Spock giveth and young Spock taketh away.
It's not like Spock needs help from me.
I can use the extra pair of hands. If Mr. Boimler is not afraid of losing one of them.
What the? Spock smiling now?
He just doesn't now. Just go with it. It's terrifying.
The lost music cue as they do a Dutch angle zoom on his teeth is something to behold. And finally, in my fun audio collection, is this scene after Boimler and Mariner tried to independently contact the Orions to broker a deal but get caught by Enterprise security and get taken to Captain Pike.
And Miss Mariner, I thought you were here to save your friend, not make a situation worse.
Look, it was all me, okay? I don't think Boimler can handle getting thrown in the brig by a guy he dressed up as for Halloween.
Oh, he... Really?
Yeah, he had to contour the hell out of the jawline, too.
It was a process, yeah.
All right, and my next little section is actually, I would say, a subsection of fun, and that is all the Star Trek little references and cute little asides they do. Nothing too serious here, just a lot of Lower Deck style fan service. So the first scene back in the Enterprise after they discover Boimler is Number One and Pike walking the halls with Boimler's communicator badge.
Mr. Spock ran an analysis of this Delta. It's not just a badge, it's also a communicator. You just press right here.
But flipping it open is the best part.
I like ours better, too.
True. Flipping open is the best part. That's why we all miss flip phones. Meanwhile, Boimler, like an audiophile surrounded by vintage receivers and record players, is enthralled by the classic gadgets of the time.
And is that a classic TS-122 tricorder?
It's a 120.
Do you mind if... Can I hold it? Just thank you so much. Oh, my God. They never improved on these. I mean, yeah, they got smaller and more powerful and arguably less likely to explode, but design-wise...
Explode, Michelle?
As helpful as...
Reference to the canon-inducted Next Generation Picard Gets Stabbed flashback episode, Tapestry is made.
Wait, you know these symbols?
Seen them before. Starbase Earhart. Guy tried to trade me a Domjot set.
What's Domja?
It's this billiards game that Nausicaans are terrible at, yet love to bet on for some reason.
Shout out, Ari. When Mariner scares Boimler in a dark shuttle, we not only get a Q mention, but a reference to his closest original series equivalent, and aptly for this time travel story we're talking about, a character we will see in a future Strange New Worlds episode.
Holy Q!
Don't yell Q! They haven't met him yet! They had kind of a Trelane thing going on.
What are you doing?
What are you doing?
We didn't mention by name, but that's who we call R in our universe. Realizing the Enterprise, in fact, has a source of portal fuel on board, we get a couple references to the original NX-01 Enterprise grapplers here.
Okay, so one time Boimler dragged me to the Starship History Museum.
Dragged? You ran up to the doors.
No, I didn't. It was boring. I hated it. Anyway, so they had the NX-01 there, Archer's Enterprise.
Yeah, classic design, plus it had, you know, the grapplers.
Skip that part, they don't care.
I love grapplers.
See?
All right.
And this follow-up at Mariner's expense.
Do you know where the section is located?
Oh. I don't, but...
Surprise, I paid attention.
Without being asked.
This guy was distracted by the grapplers.
It is surprising because she normally does not pay attention.
And lastly, the sweet little capper on this episode, towards the end, but not exactly at, regarding Una, which folds in her Star Trek civil rights trial from earlier in the season in the episode Ad Astra Per Aspera. Throughout the episode, Boimler acts squirrely when Una approaches him, like here when he runs away in the middle of a conversation with Mariner.
Exactly, that's right? What I said.
What are you... hi. Is something wrong?
Just wondering if everyone from the future looks at me like they know I'm doomed.
Okay, so that is just Boimler. He is probably freaked out because you're number one. I mean, he has a poster of you up in his bunk.
A poster? You mean like a pinup poster?
It's a poster that is pinned up. Are we saying the same thing?
It is not fear, of course. It's admiration overload for someone who fought for what was just and shaped Starfleet into what Boimler joined in his time.
Is there a problem, Ensign?
Listen, I may have given you the wrong impression about Boimler's poster. It's for recruitment. Yeah, you're the literal poster girl slash woman for Starfleet.
You should have led with that part. Is this true?
Yes, sir. Number one, sir. It was a really big reason why I joined. Ad Astra per Aspera.
They put that on the poster?
And I put it in my bunk. I meant for that to sound a lot more admiring than it did.
Your flagrant disregard for temporal protocols by telling me this is deeply troubling. Thanks all the same.
And that ends my illustrative but not exhaustive case for a crossover episode that successfully and noddingly brings together two shows with humor, winky fan service, and heart.
Thank you, Dave. Nick, you chose this from our list of submissions. Start us off.
Okay, so yeah, my background with Star Trek is pretty limited, so that's part of why I was curious to check this one out. And also, I know that you guys have talked very admiringly of both of these shows, so I thought it would be a good intro for me. I definitely enjoyed it. I definitely felt lost at times. It felt a little bit like hanging out with a group of people who all had a lot of in-jokes that I didn't understand. But
oh, Nick, that's so gravy of you.
They touched on broad enough Star Trek knowledge and tropes that I was, you know, obviously I understand that Spock is the totally logical one. So it's very weird if he laughs and shows emotion and stuff like that. I thought the actors were all great. It's interesting to have voice actors who are capable of popping out and being live action actors as well. I especially really like Tawny Newsome in that role. I hadn't known her from before, but she's great. In general, it reflects, it seems to reflect what I've gathered over the years from Star Trek as I've tried to like sample bits of it. It definitely, it does just still have this like distinct sci-fi vibe that is not quite for me, but I still feel like this show was a good example of what has been appealing about it over the years. And I think even though I couldn't personally appreciate all the aspects that they were cleverly having fun with all of the tropes and knowledge, I can see that they did a really good job of that. And I can, you know, definitely see in the alternate universe where I was a Star Trek viewer, this just being absolute catnip for how it puts all these things together into a, you know, a funny and, you know, an intriguing story. So I'm not sure how I'll vote. I'll see what other people think, but, yeah, it was definitely an interesting window into these shows.
I'll go next since I'm the one who has watched Lower Decks and Strange New Worlds. Dave is right. What makes this canon worthy, in my opinion, as well, is that it's just fun. It's so silly. You know, having the whole problem boiled down to we ran out of portal juice is like classic Star Trek. Clearly, the real logline for this episode is what if the cast of an animated show and a live action show met? That was the reason for this, and the details of the science and stuff don't really matter so much. And it is sweet. It also has heart. Dave didn't touch on the fact that, or didn't really get into the whole business about Tendi, the Orion character in Lower Decks, like insisting that it was Orion's who discovered this portal in the first place. And, you know, when Boimler comes back from the past, he can report that they changed that. Everyone knows it now, and Orions are getting their proper due as scientists, as well as mostly pirates. What I loved the most watching it this time was how much, especially Jack Quaid, but also Tawny Newsome, captures the physicality of their animated characters. There's little exclamations and stuff that Boimler does that are so funny coming out of a live action person that you sort of take for granted on the animated show. And there's a point where they're talking by themselves, I think, in the shuttle, where Mariner's like, have you noticed how slow they all talk? Because yeah. They talk so fast.
Slower and quieter. I
think. Slower yeah. and quieter.
Well, you'll notice a lot of the clips I had to fade out on somebody else answering over the words of the previous talker, which yes. doesn't usually happen. But because they're emulating that animated Lower Decks speaking style, I just couldn't avoid it. So like there was like six or seven of those.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a testament to how they adapted.
And, you know, also running under all of this is like, this is what it's like to be a person in a Star Trek show. You go to cons and people know everything about your life and the show you're on more than you do. And you just sort of have to play along with it and appreciate how much they love you. And sometimes it's annoying, but mostly it's sweet. And I liked that aspect of the episode, too. And if you enjoy Tawny Newsom, I'm going to recommend her podcast, Yo, Is This Racist? And it's Patreon.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Subscriber-only version, Yo, Can We Live?, which is not about racism. It's just more of a hangout show. It's her and Andrew T. and their producer, Kevin. So look those up as well. Put them in the show notes. Sarah.
I had watched this, I think, more recently than you guys, because Dan and I were working our way through Strange New Worlds. We are now caught up. I didn't think the third season was super successful. Things felt really siloed. And so it was really a pleasure to return to the second season, and in particular to this episode, which, like, I'm not familiar with the animated version, but they sort of brought you exactly up to speed enough, like Nick was saying. Like, I think that whatever level of Star Trek you speak, you will be able to understand this conversational Star Trek, right down to the title, that this is what Boimler calls, like, that's what TOS stands for. Mm-hmm. For Boimler is those old scientists, which made me smile that he continually is like, you know, Worf's honor, damn it. And like keeps forgetting, like, well, you know, it's like, of course I know his birthday. It's a holiday. Crap. It was just very well done, sort of a seamless transition. And you're absolutely right that they do inhabit a certain like animated boing physicality, but it's not too cartoonish. Mm-hmm. It's perfect. It's very funny. I think it does showcase the way that Strange New Worlds can be both hilarious and timed really well with comedy, but also switch gears pretty easily. Like, you know, numero uno, no one calls her that, being really touched that, like, they put that on the poster. And it just reminded me all over again that they don't actually give Rebecca Romijn enough to do mm-hmm. on that show, except have really bafflingly bad wigs mm-hmm. for the future. But anyway, that is her choice, and enough about that. The exchange that Dave clipped about the, like, when they're all on the bridge and it's like really great hair, and there's that perfectly timed pause and the line delivery on Hail the Orions. So good. I wrote down so many bits of dialogue that made me laugh. Mm-hmm. So many throwaway lines for Mbenga that he's like, wait, what did he say? Or like, you mean the 22? It just is very funny, but also very sweet. And the way that they do it at the end, that there's not like, as they're going back through the portal to the animated world, that there's just sort of a look exchange that's like, well, you know, we did this and didn't manage to tear a hole in the fabric of time. See you later, maybe. It was sweet. And then the button is the best. I watched it twice. That Strange New Worlds is now in 2D. And as they're realizing that and freaking out, it's really well done. Mm-hmm. I hope that these franchises find a way to cross over again. Mm-hmm. When a Star Trek franchise realizes that it's kind of run out of new things to say as itself and needs to come up with like gimmick episodes, that can really be magical. And this was really fun, and everyone involved was having a ton of fun. And that's one of the things that I like best about Strange New Worlds, is that everyone seems to really be digging the process.
Yeah, I'll just P.S. This made me very excited for the puppet episode. I agree that season 3 of Strange New Worlds was kind of a mixed bag. But a couple mm-hmm. more number one things. Credit to The Next Generation's number one. Jonathan Frakes directed this episode. There's a cute moment at the end when we go back to the Lower Decks world, and it's Ransom commenting on Una's poster and calling her the hottest number one in Starfleet, because that is voiced by Jerry O'Connell, Rebecca Romijn's husband, which is also cute.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Pop quiz, something I learned while doing this presentation. Ad Astra per Aspera is the motto of what state as well? To the stars with difficulty or challenge is what it means.
Alabama?
Oh, a state? I thought it was like NASA or something.
Kansas, for some reason.
Huh. Yeah. Okay.
It's on their state flag.
Well, you can see a lot of stars there,
I guess. What else are you going to do, right? You're in Kansas.
Get swept up in a tornado and taken to mm-hmm. Oz.
All right, let's work this backwards. Sarah D. Bunting?
It's a yes for me.
Tara Ariano?
Yes.
And Nick Reinwell Jones, what are you going to do?
Well, I don't want to be on the wrong side of alternate history, so I'll say yes as well.
Very good. So... Star Trek Strange New World Season 2, Episode 7, Those Old Scientists. You are hereby inducted into the extra hot great canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time to discover our winner and loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I do. It's oh my God, I was about to say the newsroom's Dave Foley. I'm so sorry. News Radio's Dave Foley, among other shows, for whom Amy Mann wrote her Oscar-nominated song, Save Me. I can't believe I didn't know this bit of trivia before. I'm not necessarily steeped in Foley lore, but certainly I've been to enough Amy Mann shows and read enough newsletters. You'd think I would have known that, but yeah.
So basically, if you were a sitcom actor in the 90s named Dave, you automatically got a lady rock song written about you.
That was in my notes. So, yes.
And loser of the week.
Loser of the week is the MTV clip show Ridiculousness, which last week was canceled at MTV after 46 seasons and 1,700 episodes.
Jesus.
Curiously, just one day after Bloomberg reported that host Rob Dyrdek was getting paid at least $32 million a year for the show. So it seems like someone at Paramount was like, wait, what? Call that guy and pull the plug.
It's the Milton and Office Space of MTV hosts.
Truly.
They might as well just collapse like all of their dead cable channels into one at this point. Like, what are they even showing on Comedy Central other than South Park and The Daily Show?
Well,
who knows?
Speaking about collapsing the dead, do you know what time it is?
It's game time. Yeah,
gotta be game time.
All right, this is the first game time of the season. Our scores are Tara 0, Sarah 0, Value Guest 0, and we are playing Odd Age Out from Mr. Dan Cassino.
Damn you, Cassino!
Who earns himself an extra credit topic of his choosing, plus a free shirt from our store. Dan writes, I had a birthday recently. Happy birthday. And if I have to feel old, everyone has to feel old. In this game, I'm going to give you the names of three actors, along with when they started or ended a notable TV role. Two of the three were within a year or so in age at the times noted. One was not. You have to identify which is the odd person out. Get it right for 2 points. Then, after the answer is revealed, you must tell me whether they are older or younger than the other two for an additional point. So 3 points per question at stake. All right, let's throw it to Picky to see who is going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right, our order will be Tara, Nick, then Sarah. We've got 30 questions, maybe an equalizer challenge zone, depending on time. Are we ready to play Odd Age Out?
Yes, sir.
You bet.
Yes.
All right, let's start with Tara. Your three are Angela Lansbury at the last episode of Murder, She Wrote, 1996. Dick Van Dyke, last episode of Diagnosis Murder, 2001, or Kathy Bates, premiere of Matlock, 2024. Two of them are the same age at these points in their lives. One of them is not. But which one?
Dick Van Dyke.
That is incorrect. Dick Van Dyke and Kathy Bates, same age at those particular points. Angela Lansbury, odd one out, but was she younger or older than the other two?
Younger.
Younger is correct for 1 point. She was 71. The others were 76.
Okay.
Ow.
Nick.
So that's half of how you do it.
You've got Ron Howard, premiere of Happy Days, 1976. Scott Baio, first appearance of Happy Days, 1977. And Tori Spelling, premiere of Beverly Hills 90210, 1990. Two were the same age, one was not. Name the one that was not. Ron Howard, Scott Baio, Tori Spelling.
I'm going to say Scott Baio.
Scott Baio is incorrect. Scott Baio and Tori Spelling were the same age. Ron Howard was not, but was he older at the premiere of Happy Days or younger?
Younger.
He was older. Wow. He was 20 when Happy Days started. Scott Baio and Tori Spelling, 17.
Yeah, they were really young.
Oh, man.
Sarah, you've got Al Molinaro, Al, from the premiere of Happy Days, again, 1976. Mm-hmm. Fred Thompson in his first episode of Law & Order, 2002. Or William B. Davis, that is the cigarette-smoking man, from the premiere of The X-Files, 1993. At those points in their lives, two were the same age. One was not. Name the one that was not.
Oh, God. I'm going to say cigarette-smoking man, William B.
No, he and Al were the same age. Fred was not, but was Fred older at this point or younger? His first episode versus the premiere of X-Files and the premiere of Happy Days.
Jesus. I think he was younger.
He was 60. The other two, 55.
Oh, this is starting to feel like calling him 30 Rock.
Big Al. I feel like that's one where you could have said, no, he was 47. I'd be like, sure.
Yeah. Elliot Gould, premiere of Friends, 1994. Mm-hmm. Jerry Orbach, first episode of Law & Order, 1991. Mm-hmm. Tom Bosley, premiere of Happy Days, 1976.
Oh, shit. That's rough.
Bosley.
Bosley is our first correct answer in the first part of the question. Is he younger or older?
Younger.
You are correct. Hey! 3-point answer. He was 49 at the start of Happy Days. Orbach and Gould, 56.
Crazy.
56.
Wow.
Back to all Nick. Right. Chris Noth, premiere of Sex and the City, 1998. Ed Asner, premiere of Mary Tyler Moore Show in 1970. Peter Falk, premiere of Columbo, 1971.
Here's what's crazy. They were all in their 30s.
Yeah.
All right. Who's the odd one out?
Okay. Say Chris Noth.
Incorrect. He and Peter Falk, same age on their premieres of Sex and the City and
That's
Columbo.
Fucking crazy.
Asner has a different age for the premiere of Mary Tyler Moore Show. Was it older or younger than the other two?
Younger.
Correct.
Hey!
Noth and Falk, how old during their premiere episodes?
Okay, so that was Noth in 98?
Yeah, and Columbo 71.
I'm going to say I was joking before, but like 39?
39?
43?
43 is very close. 44.
Well,
oh, wow.
Ed Asner, younger. 41. Yes.
My God.
41, yeah.
70s.
Before the days.
41, 70, yeah.
People drank water. They
Add
really
one day
them.
For each cigarette smoked.
Sarah Day Bunting, David Cross, premiere of Breasted Development, 2003. Henry Winkler, last episode of Happy Days, 1984. Last episode of Happy Days. Wayne Knight, his first episode of Seinfeld, which was 92. David Cross, start of Arrested Development. Henry Winkler, last episode of Happy Days. Wayne Knight, his first episode of Seinfeld.
I think it's the Fonz, Henry Winkler.
It is not. David Cross, Henry Winkler, the same age. Wayne Knight, odd man out. Wayne Knight, older or younger?
Oh, my God. Younger.
Correct.
Yeah!
He was 34 for his first episode of Seinfeld. Winkler and Cross, 39.
39, the Fonz.
Wow.
Oh my God.
At the end. Amazing.
At the end, yeah. Tara.
Yeah.
Gillian Anderson, premiere of X-Files, 93. Mm-hmm. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, her first episode of Seinfeld, 1990.
Yep.
Mary Tyler Moore, premiere of The Dick Van Dyke Show, 1961.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So Anderson, star of The X-Files, 93.
Yep.
Dreyfus?
Yep.
Louis Dreyfus, 1990. Mary Tyler Moore, 1961.
Anderson.
Dyke Show. Anderson is your answer, and you are. Anderson and Mary Tyler Moore, same age. Julia Louis Dreyfus is not. Older or younger?
Older.
Older is correct. She was 28, and the others were 25.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I knew Gillian Anderson was crazy young at the start of X-Files. But
Nick Reinwell Jones, Aaron Paul, premiere of Breaking Bad, 2008. Henry Winkler, premiere of Happy Days, 1974. Ian Ziering, premiere of Beverly Hills, 90210, 1990. So you got Aaron Paul, start of Breaking Bad. Henry Winkler, start of Happy Days. Ian Ziering, start of Beverly Hills 90210.
Okay, well, now I have some information to draw on because I know that Henry Winkler was 39 in 1984. So if I do some quick math in my head here. Aaron Paul.
Aaron Paul is incorrect. Ugh. Aaron Paul, Henry Winkler, same age at their premieres. Ian Ziering, odd man out, younger or older than the other two?
Older.
Younger. He was 26. Really? 26 at the start of that show. Playing what?
Playing like 16.
Yeah.
All right, so like a decade too old.
This just came up because he was in Sassy and what he said, and he did not disclose his age.
Mumble,
and they
mumble.
Said, we guessed 25. He was in fact 27. That was in the June 91 issue.
3 years younger, 29 for the other two. Sarity Bunting, Drea Di Matteo, premiere of Sopranos, 1999. Jennifer Aniston, premiere of Friends, 1994. Pamela Anderson, her first episode of Baywatch, which was 92. Two are the same age. One is not.
Was the middle one?
Jennifer Aniston at the start of Friends, 94.
I think it's Aniston.
Nope. Oh my God. Her terrible and Pamela Anderson are the same age. Drea Di Matteo is not, but is she older or younger? At the start of The Sopranos.
The start of The Sopranos, I think she was older.
You're correct. Yay! She was 27 to their 25. Tara.
Yeah.
Jamie Lynn Sigler from The Sopranos, premiere of 1999 again. Luke Perry, premiere of Beverly Hills 90210, 1990. Sally Struthers, premiere of All in the Family, 1971. Two are the same age at that time. One is not.
Sigler.
Sigler is correct. Older or younger?
Nice.
Younger.
You are correct. She was 18 in 1999 when The Sopranos started. Perry and Struthers, 24. 24. Christopher Knight is your first. Nick, premiere of The Brady Bunch, 1969. Frankie Muniz, premiere of Malcolm in the Middle, 2000. Michael Cera, premiere of Arrested Development, 2003.
Ooh.
Oh, man. Brutal. I mean, it would already be hard if I knew who Christopher Knight was. But
it's the middle one.
He's Peter.
He's Peter. Okay. Muniz.
Incorrect. He and Sarah, same age. Christopher Knight is the odd one out. But was he younger or older?
Younger.
Younger is correct. Yes, he was 12. The other were 15. All right, this one's for Sarah. It will take us into our score break. You got Carol O'Connor, premiere of All in the Family, 1971. John Slattery, premiere of Mad Men, 2007. Patrick Stewart, premiere of Next Generation, 87. Which one is the odd one out?
Casino, you bastard.
He did say this is going to make people angry, probably. So.
Yeah, this is not cute. Carol O'Connor.
Nope. He and Stewart both guesses.
They're like
41.
38 or something, right? Yeah,
47.
Oh, God. Wow.
All right. John Slattery, younger or older? I shouldn't have given that information. But
premiere of Mad Men?
Yeah, premiere of Mad Men, 2007.
Older.
45. What? 2 years younger.
Oh, no.
All right. We need the scores, please.
Are you sure? Nick and Sarah are tied with 2. I have 8.
Okay. 2 points. All right.
Oh, boy.
All right. Shake it off, guys. All right. Tara.
Yeah.
Back with Angela Lansbury. Premiere of Murder, She Wrote.
Okay.
1984.
Right.
Estelle Getty. Premiere of Golden Girls, 1985. Jessica Walter, premiere of Arrested Development, 2003. Two
Getty.
Same age, one isn't.
Getty.
Said with confidence, you are incorrect. Getty and Walter, same age. Lansbury, not. Younger or older?
Older.
You older?
Yes,
that's
older.
A big goose egg for you on that one. Younger, oh, 62 for the others, 59.
Wow.
3 years younger.
Okay.
Oh. Holy shit. All right.
Bob Newhart, Nick. Bob Newhart. Da, 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 da. Premiere of The Bob Newhart Show, 1972. Dennis Franz, premiere of NYPD Blue, 1993. Steve Van Zandt, premiere of Sopranos, 1999. Who's the odd one out? Age-wise.
Newhart.
Correct.
Woo! Oh,
younger or older?
Younger.
Yes, 3-point oh. answer. He was 43, the other 6 years older, 49.
Good job,
I'm not a total
Damn,
loser.
I would have guessed Van Zandt. All right.
Sarah D. Bunting, Avery Brooks, premiere of Star Trek's Deep Space Nine in 93. Mm-hmm. Dean Norris, premiere of Breaking Bad, 2008. Or Mitch Pileggi, that's director Skinner, premiere of X-Files, 1993.
Three balds. Yeah. No waiting. Mm.
All of Mitch Pileggi's hair was on his chest.
All right. Who's the odd one out, Sarah?
Odd one out is Norris.
Of course. Avery Brooks and Norris were the same age on their premieres. Mitch Pileggi was not. Was he older or younger?
That's a good question.
The Pileggi.
I wish I knew the answer to it. I don't think I do, but 50-50 shot. I think he was older.
Hey!
Wrong.
Avery Brooks, 45. Dean Norris, 45. The Pileg, 41. He is young. All right, Tara. David Hasselhoff, premiere of Knight Rider, 1982.
Sure.
Jason Alexander, premiere of Seinfeld, 1989. Matthew Perry, premiere of Friends, 1994.
Perry.
Perry is correct. Older or younger?
Younger.
By how many years?
Four?
Five. Very close.
Oh, shit. Wow.
He was 25. The other's 30. All right. This is question 17.
Ready to go.
Kieran Shipka, Nick, premiere of Mad Men, 2007. Melissa Gilbert, premiere of Little House on the Prairie, 74. Susan Olsen, that's Cindy, from the premiere of Brady Bunch, 1969.
She's the youngest one.
Dun, 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 dun.
In Curls.
Yep. She's the one that's the vampire. Same show? Think of the same show? All right, so you've got Shipka, Mad Men, Gilbert, Little House, or Olsen, Brady Bunch. All premieres.
Shipka.
Shipka is not quite. The odd one out is Melissa Gilbert. Was she older or younger than the other two?
Younger?
Yeah. She was 10, the others were 8. Sarah D. Bunting, Anne B. Davis, Alice.
Oh.
Premiere of Brady Bunch, 69. Jane Kaczmarek, premiere of Malcolm in the Middle, 2000. Lorraine Bracco, premiere of Sopranos, 1999. Janice and Bor-R is a whore.
Yeah.
Do you hear me? Okay, Kaczmarek, Anne B. Davis, and Bracco.
Yeah.
I think Bracco's the odd one out.
Bracco is not the odd one out. Kaczmarek and Bracco, same age. Anne B. Davis, odd one out, younger or older?
I don't appreciate this ruse, this cunning attempt to trick me. Let's go against my instincts and say younger.
Yeah, that's right. She was 43, the other's 2 years older, 45. Tara.
Yeah.
Bea Arthur, last episode of The Golden Girls, 1992.
Yep.
Dick Van Dyke, premiere of Diagnosis Murder, 1993. Stephen Hill, his first episode of Law and Order, 1990.
Fuck.
Two of them the same age. One was not. They're all old at this point. You can tell you
that
much.
Yeah, they're all old as shit.
Arthur, Van Dyke, Hill.
Yeah. Hill?
Nope. Van Dyke and Hill, same age. Okay. B. Arthur, odd person out.
Mm-hmm.
Younger or older?
Older. Older.
Correct. 70 to their 68. And that was question 19. All right, Nick. David Hasselhoff is back for the premiere of Baywatch in 1989. Jason Bateman, premiere of Arrested Development, 2003. Michael Landon, premiere of Little House on the Prairie, 1974. At those moments in their lives, two are the same age, one was not.
Three incredible heads of hair, I think we can all agree.
Landon.
Incorrect. Oh. He and Hasselhoff are roughly the same age. Bateman, odd person out. Younger or older?
Older
or younger?
Older.
Oh, Hasselhoff and Landon, 37, 38. The math's a little weird here. I'm not quite sure.
Mm-hmm.
Bateman, 34. Younger.
Mm.
Sarah D. Bunting, you've got Courtney Cox in the premiere of Friends in 94. Mary Tyler Moore, premiere of The Mary Tyler Moore Show, 1970. Portia de Rossi, premiere of Arrested Development 2003.
Cox.
That's what I would have said too.
She and de Rossi, same age for their premieres. Mary Tyler Moore, odd person out, younger or older?
Gosh. Older.
Yes, you are correct. Gosh. Older by 4 years. She was 34 at the start of her show. The other's 30. Okay. Tara Ariano, Florence Henderson. Mm-hmm. Premiere of Brady Bunch, 69.
Yep.
Kate Mulgrew, premiere of Star Trek Shovel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a year here.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's fine.
Suzanne Plachette, premiere of the Bob Newhart Show, 72.
Plachette. Okay.
Plachette and Henderson were the same age for their premieres. Kate Mulgrew was not. Was she older or younger?
Younger.
Older. By 5 years, she was 40. The others, 35.
Crazy.
Back to Nick. He was history's greatest acting robots, David Duchovny, premiere of The X-Files, 1993. Also, David Schwimmer, premiere of Friends, 1994. Also, Dominic West, premiere of The Wire, 2002.
Oh, boy.
Two are the same age, one is not. Which one was not? Premiere of X-Files for Duchovny, premiere of Friends for Schwimmer, premiere of The Wire for West.
Schwimmer.
Correct.
Yay! Oh.
Really?
Yes. Older or younger, though?
Younger.
Yes. 3-point answer. Right. Duchovny and West, 33, and Schwimmer, 28. Much younger.
All right.
We'll do a score break after this. We're almost done. Sarah D. Bunting, Daniel J. Trevanti from the premiere of Hill Street Blues, 1981. S. Epatha Murchison, her first episode of Law and Order, 91. Wendell Pierce, premiere episode of The Wire, 2002.
Oh, boy.
Police captains and law enforcers.
Mm-hmm. Pierce?
Was that Pierce?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. That was a real tranche. that is incorrect.
Of course it is.
Murchison and Pierce, same age. Trevanti, odd one out. Older or younger?
Younger.
Older.
I love
2 years. He was 41. The others were 39.
He was in Gidget. I would have known he was.
Oh, shit. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I played an older guy in Gidget as well.
He's just one of those actors, like, irrespective of the, you know, ambient smoke era, that looked 44 for like 20
totally.
Years.
Totally. Yes.
Yeah. Tara.
Yep.
Idris Elba, premiere of The Wire, 2002.
Mm-hmm.
James Eckhouse, Jimmy X.
Yeah.
Premiere of Beverly Hills 90210, 1990.
Uh-huh. Right.
Jesse L. Martin, his first episode of Law and Order, 1999.
Martin,
said with confidence, and of course you are incorrect.
Idris Elba. Well, I didn't want to waste anyone's time. Okay.
And Martin were of a different age than Jimmy X.
Mm-hmm.
Was Jimmy X older or younger?
I feel like it's going to be like 2 years in either direction. God.
I'm going to let you know you are not correct on that either.
Oh, okay. Then I'm going to say Eckhouse is, older.
Are you sure?
No. Not. I think he was like 38. I think he was young, but I don't know if the other two were. I really don't know.
I need an answer.
What did I say?
You said older.
Okay, I'm going to stick on
said older.
You are correct.
Okay.
Yay. Nice.
He was 35.
Oh, okay, okay.
Holy the others shit. Were 30.
Wow, so
really?
He was really young in Beverly Hills Cop.
Boy.
Yep.
Well,
Nick Reinwell Jones.
Being a parent to Brandon really put some years on
you.
Straight from the canon, it's Anson Mount, premiere of Strange New Worlds in 2022. Bryan Cranston, premiere of Malcolm in the Middle in the year 2000. Richard Belzer, premiere of Homicide, 1993. Two the same age, one was not.
Oh, my God. Speaking of people that just became an age and stayed that way for 30 years.
Yeah. Anson Mount, Cranston Mount, and Belzer Mount.
Yeah.
I'm going to say Belzer.
Belzer and Mount were the same age for their premiere.
Boy, oh boy.
Cranston, or Malcolm in the Middle 2000 was not. Was he older or younger?
Older.
Nope. He was 44 to their 49. 5 years younger, in fact. Sarah D. Bunting, Andy Griffith, premiere of Matlock, 1986. Chris Noth, premiere of And Just Like That, 2021. Peter Falk, last episode of Columbo, which was 1994.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Tough one. That's a really tough one.
Yeah. It's fucking brutal. Griffith.
Correct.
Hey!
Noth and Falk, same age. Griffith, different. Younger, older.
Younger.
Way younger. 7 years younger.
Wow.
He was 60, Noth 67, Falk 67.
Boy.
All right, everybody's last question is coming at you. Here comes Tara's.
Okay.
Andre Brower, premiere of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, 2013. Mm-hmm. Rue McClanahan, premiere of Golden Girls, 1985. Scott Bakula, premiere of Star Trek Enterprise, 2001.
Blah.
Keep in mind, he's immortal.
Of course. I'm going to say Bakula.
Correct.
Woo.
All right. Younger or older?
Younger.
Younger is also correct. He was 47 asterisk to their 51.
Okay.
Nick Reinwald Jones' last question is Andy Griffith for his last episode of Matlock, 1995. Estelle Getty, last episode of Golden Girls, 1992. Tom Selleck, premiere of Blue Bloods, 2010. All right, two are the same age, one is not. The last episodes for Griffith and Getty, premiere of Blue Bloods for Selleck.
Selleck.
Correct. Woo! Younger or older?
Nice.
What year was Blue Bloods again?
2010.
2010? I'm going to say older.
Younger. Oh. He was 65, and the others, 69.
Nice.
69. Yes. Nice. All right, last question of the game. Sarah, we've got Betty White finally appearing in our age quiz. Premiere of Hot in Cleveland, 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick Stewart, premiere of Picard, 2020. Tom Selleck, last episode of Blue Bloods last year, 2024. Two same age, one is not.
White is not.
White is the correct answer, Woo! Yes. Was she older or younger?
Older.
Older is also correct. Yay. She was 88, the other 79 to 80.
Patrick Stewart in Hot in Space. Tom Selleck in All Hot Cops Are Bastards.
Blue Space.
All right, that is regulation. Scores, please.
Okay. Nick and Sarah each finished with 10 points. I had 16. Ooh,
nicely done. Thank you,
nice
Dan. That game
job
was infuriating to all
yes,
of our contestants. I can tell.
Dan, you casino indeed.
Tara.
Ara.
Me.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. Some of us followed, and others blocked I Love L.A. before going around the dial with stops at Nobody Wants This, Wayward, Aline, Queen of the Serial Killers, that's with an S, Strange New Worlds, Those Old Scientists, crossed over into the canon, we crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Dan. Next up, it's Death by Lightning on Extra Extra Hot Great. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariana,
5 digits, totally normal date to be living in,
Sarah D. Bunting,
Art Sparks Bad,
and Nick Reinwell Jones,
it's up in my bunk.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
I know me being here wasn't ideal and potentially reality threatening, but meeting all of you has been one of the greatest experiences of my life. Thank you.